Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, on the web at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, The Freedom Project is a new theatrical production looking at Black history in Florida.
We can certainly work towards a more perfect Florida and have a Florida that really includes us all and really speaks to all the stories that you can find here in this wonderful state we call home.
We'll discuss the Equal Rights Amendment in Florida.
The study examines the fight leading up to the 1977 defeat of the measure by looking at the media's coverage of the ERA battles, women versus women themes, and Senator Lori Wilson's mediated representation.
And we'll talk about American origins in Spanish Florida. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers.
Take this protest to the newspapers. You think you can get this published?
Okay. So what's the headline gonna be? Famous artists draw colored lines against...
Against me?
Yeah.
Shoot, I'm mad enough to spit. And not just against me, but against the whole race. For all of us denied the opportunity to create as artists.
That's Whitney Fain and Adorian Owens performing a scene from a play they wrote about the experiences of Florida sculptor Augusta Savage, set in 1923. Their work is being incorporated into a new theatrical production called The Freedom Project that looks at African-American history in Florida with music, poetry, dance, and more. The production will be performed July 29th at the Abbey in downtown Orlando. The Freedom Project is being produced by the Florida Theatrical Association, the organization that brings touring Broadway shows to Orlando, Fort Lauderdale, and Miami. Khalid Tapia is operations coordinator for the FTA.
We want to bring to life the folklore, the poems, the songs of some of the most famous African-American Floridians. And we did a casting and things started rolling from there. You know, people started coming in, bringing their creativity, and we are at the point now where we're having a great show for people to see, in addition to the fact that it's historical and it's going to be educational for people to learn.
Brandon Martin is artistic director for the Freedom Project.
We've kind of thought of a way that we could feature Black history, and through the discussions between Khalid and myself, we decided to focus on Florida history. And actually, because I am a fan of your show, of Florida Frontiers, I think that helped want to focus on Florida history, but specifically Black history that has been made in Florida, or people from Florida who have contributed to American history and culture as a whole.
Khalid Tapia and Brandon Martin knew that they wanted to include writer, folklorist, and anthropologist Zora Neale Hurston in the Freedom Project, as well as sculptor and arts educator Augusta Savage, and brothers James Weldon Johnson and John Rosamond Johnson, who wrote the song Lift Every Voice and Sing, also known as the Black National Anthem. The cast members of the Freedom Project have expanded that original vision, working as collaborators to develop the production.
So we have people that are choreographing their own dances. We have someone who pretty much wrote their own 10 to 15 minute play, which is amazing. And people that have written their own scenes. And it's just bringing this history to light in such an amazing and engaging way. I'm very proud to see it unfold.
Arias West is a collaborator on the Freedom Project, incorporating step dancing into the production.
we all collectively want to kind of come together to uplift the stories of Floridians, specifically in Black trailblazers here in Florida. So we had this research done by the director of it all, the main director, and our cultural coordinator, who kind of came up with these very important people who kind of created songs and poetry and wrote books and had these really interesting stories. So we all, who was cast in the show, we all had different skill sets, you know, that came together to kind of pick and choose which part of the Florida story we want to tell. So what, I guess a part of my process has been just kind of adding my way of shining or my strong suits to tell stories. You know, at the end of the day, we're all storytellers. And if we're going to talk about certain subjects, what is the best way to express these subjects? Is it through a monologue? Is it through singing or acting? And we wanted to kind of do it all, but I also am a dancer. So what I guess my role is kind of incorporating like the dance element to help tell a story, and specifically step, which is a percussive kind of style dance, which comes from our ancestors, and it kind of like really gives like a rooted feel for what I was going for with my story. While we were doing research and looking through all of these collective people and stories and poems and all of these things, I found this little story about this town in St. Augustine called Fort Mose. And the guy who kind of protected Fort Mose, his name was Captain Francisco Menendez. And so I did a little more digging due to the links that they provided to us, of course. I just did more research and I found out that this was actually the first free Black community. And I was like, wait, I thought Eatonville, which is, you know, like 20 minutes away right here in Orlando. I was like, I thought Eatonville was, and I'm looking at the difference. I have to do more research and I'm seeing that Eatonville was the first established, like fully incorporated Black community where, you know, we have the benefits and the resources and we're working and, you know, but this community, they had to kind of like be in a hideout in a sense, Fort Mose. So that's how I kind of like got to this story. So seeing that this was happening, to get to tie in how I'm using step to do this, a couple of years ago, I did a project where I talked about like the a very similar story where the Africans came over. They were working in the slave mines and they did gumboots to communicate. And I wanted to tell the story of how it went from gumboot to stepping in colleges and fraternities, and then how it's like a freedom of expression. And I was like, it would be cool if I can kind of go through that same movement of how the Africans came over. They were here in British colonial territory, and then they came down to St. Augustine, Florida, and had this this community. And then nowadays, it kind of went away for a while, but now it's preserved and people don't know about it, but they do now. And it's in St. Augustine. So like all of this history, I thought it would be great to just kind of use those same elements, but to tell a new story and add new steps and add new vocals and chants and dances to tell this new, very similar, but like a new story, you know?
Fort Mose was established by the Spanish in 1738 as a free colony for people escaping British slavery in colonies north of Florida. The Underground Railroad ran south before it traveled north. The creators of the Freedom Project are basing their production on history, but also hope that it provides an opportunity to reflect upon the present and future. Felicia Chavon is cultural coordinator for the Freedom Project.
We can become our own historical archaeologist and really treasure and value our stories and allow that to be a foundation for the history that we continue to make. So I hope that it will be a catalyst for people to go from passive to active in remembering our history, owning our history, and allowing that to be a part of our healing as a community, because, you know, remembering and remembrance is a part of healing.
Artistic director Brandon Martin.
My hope is that that we learn, obviously, that we are entertained. We definitely want to entertain and engage and start conversation and get us to think about where Florida has been, what it is now, and what it can become. It's in our Constitution. We're always striving for a more perfect union, and we can certainly work towards a more perfect Florida and have a Florida that really includes us all and really speaks to all the stories that you can find here in this wonderful state we call home.
The Freedom Project will be presented July 29th at the Abbey in downtown Orlando. Admission is free, but tickets must be reserved in advance at eventbrite.com.
And now I get a letter from the American Committee. My scholarship has been withdrawn for fear that selling with the likes of me might offend white girls off to see gay prairie.
This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime at myfloridahistory.org to find great books on Florida history and culture. Listen to archived editions of this program, watch our public television series Florida Frontiers, and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org.
I am woman, hear me roar, in numbers too big to ignore, and I know too much to go back and pretend.
Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, Kimberly Wilmot Voss, a professor of journalism at the University of Central Florida, is well known to many members of the Florida Historical Society and readers of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Her research focuses on women in journalism and reporting on women's issues.
In a 2009 article in the Quarterly, Voss looks at the media reporting of the several efforts by the Florida State Legislature to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment. As she states, the study examines the fight leading up to the 1977 defeat of the measure by looking at the media's coverage of the ERA battles, women versus women themes, and Senator Lori Wilson's mediated representation. The Equal Rights Amendment has a long history. First introduced in both houses of Congress in 1923, it was conceived by Alice Paul. A Quaker, suffragist, and leader of the National Women's Party, she was identified as more radical than many of her fellow suffragists, as she adopted the actions of British suffragettes and organized suffrage parades and picketing before the White House in support of the vote for women. Efforts to bring the ERA before the states for ratification were unsuccessful until 1972, when Congress enacted legislation for the amendment. In quick succession, a number of states ratified the amendment, which stated, quote, "Equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex," end quote. Two additional sections gave Congress the power to enforce appropriate legislation supporting the amendment and indicated that the amendment would take effect 2 years after the date of ratification. Florida considered ratification three times in 1972, 1974, and 1977, but failed to ratify the amendment. The ERA inaction mimicked earlier consideration of women's rights. In 1920, Florida did not bring the 19th Amendment for women's suffrage before the legislature for ratification, although several cities already allowed women to vote in local elections. In 1969, the legislature symbolically ratified the 19th Amendment. Voss places her work within the context of previous studies on Florida, the South, and the ERA, but distinguishes her research by focusing on the media in reporting the events and determining the outcomes. By focusing attention on a pivotal figure and casting the battles between women as catfights, she says, the media lost the opportunity to engage in the larger role of explaining the impact of the ERA and facilitating broader public discussion.
The consideration of the ERA was a time for serious discussion. Labeling it as a catfight seems unnecessarily derogatory.
It does. As with so many aspects of efforts to ratify the ERA, and similar to the push for the 19th Amendment in 1920, labeling the debates between pro- and anti-ERA groups as catfights robbed the moment of its policy importance and relegated it to the realm of screeching noise with few historical implications. The ERA mattered to women on both sides of the issues. Nor was either side entirely unified in its support or opposition. In addition, both sides argued over the methods to be used in the fight. On the pro-ERA side, divisions between the so-called old guard and new guard, that is, women in professional roles who had been involved in earlier feminist fights, and those new to the fight who often arrived through civil rights, stymied the creation of a unified voice for ERA advocates. Some leaders, such as Betty Friedan, were portrayed as divisive and too removed from typical women to represent their views. They agreed, however, that a constitutional amendment was needed to move women from the status of second-class citizens. In many states, women could not own land, obtain a mortgage, or obtain credit in their own name. Until 1968, a Florida woman who wanted to go into business on her own had to petition the court to demonstrate her competence and good character. More unified in their opposition, the anti-ERA arguments focused on concerns that ratification of the amendment would lead to unisex bathrooms, the elimination of alimony, and the legalization of gay marriage. Voss notes that the two reasons most cited for opposition to the ERA were conscription of women into the military service and the breakdown of the family. Citing other studies, Voss notes that in the South, feminism competed for space within the public rhetoric still struggling with issues of race. As an example, she points to claims of anti-family lodged against ERA supporters who advocated government-supported daycare. Opponents claimed the centers created by the ERA would take children away from their families, just as busing had literally taken children away from their families in the process of desegregation.
Connie, how did the media depict these differences and influence the outcome of the ratification?
Voss argues that the language used by the media was condescending and negative. As an example, the women's strike for equality on August 26, 1970, was the largest women's protest in American history to that point. But media coverage focused on throwaway quips by men. Vice President Spiro Agnew noted that three things have been difficult to tame: the oceans, fools, and women. We may soon be able to tame the ocean, but fools and women will take a little longer. On the national level, not all ERA proponents saw the media as unsupportive. Activist Susan Brown Miller, historian Carol Mueller, and journalist David Broder point to the role newspapers and magazines played in highlighting the issues and unifying the forces of ratification. Voss points to the media failure to provide analysis of the amendment and questions the claims by each side as contributing to the state's failure to ratify the ERA. While most newspapers focused on the catfight that erupted between the opposing sides, polls indicated that Floridians supported ratifications by a wide margin. Political figures who claimed that the people of Florida don't want the ERA to pass were not challenged. On the editorial pages, letters for and against ratification were paired, giving the impression that support for the amendment was weaker than the polls indicated. Both the Miami Herald and the St. Petersburg Times championed the ERA, but even there, the support was framed by male journalists, since women played a limited role in the creation of mainstream media messages. In addition to shaping the rhetoric, media focused on personalities rather than messages. The emergence of Gloria Steinem and Phyllis Schlafly provided media with national figures who were articulate and photogenic. In Florida, that role was played by Brevard Senator Lori Wilson. Elected as an independent, she emerged as the sponsor and principal advocate of the ERA in Florida. In a speech before the Senate on April the 10th, 1974, she tied ratification of the ERA to the nation's history of liberty, but did not move the legislature to ratification. By January 1977, ratification seemed in reach. 18 senators vowed to support ERA and 13 were against, leaving 9 senators undeclared. By April, however, a series of vote switches put ratification in doubt. When the measure failed, Wilson placed the blame on, quote, the good old boys in Southern legislatures, but she predicted they were clutching at pseudo-power that will not last. Voss concludes that the blame fell on several actors. The Florida ERA was not well organized and did not spend time debunking anti-ERA myths. But she saves her principal blame for the media, for its failure to analyze the issues or use the polling numbers to question the statements by elected officials that the people did not want the ERA. She also notes that although Senator Wilson commanded the attention of the media, journalists used her image frequently but gave her little airtime. The role of the media, Voss concludes, should be considered as a factor in the defeat of the ERA in the Florida legislature.
It's amazing that this legislation still hasn't become law. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. Sebastian Garcia has this look at how some aspects of American culture originated in Spanish Florida.
Dr. Kevin Cocomore is a historian of early America. He focuses on the Southeast region and its multi-ethnic dimensions, including indigenous, Spanish, and European influences. He has been teaching at Coastal Carolina University since 2012. Dr. Cocomore is also the author of La Florida, Catholics, Conquistadors, and Other American Origin Stories, published by Pineapple Press in September 2023. In the book, Dr. Cocomore examines the often overlooked Spanish influences that were central to the development of early America, from the Age of Exploration to Colonial America. By integrating Spanish heritage within the larger narrative of early American history, Dr. Cocomore challenges certain fundamental notions that characterize the early years of the American past. Perhaps the most enduring of these fundamental notions is the origins of Thanksgiving.
The irony there is that we don't know a whole lot. But the reality is we don't know a whole lot about what happened in New England either, right? You know, Edward Winslow, I think, and is one of like the two guys that mentions the first Thanksgiving. And he basically says Massasoit and the Wampanoag come in with some settlers and we basically have a harvest feast. And for them, you know, historians have expanded that, right? Based on those two excerpts. And I actually draw on the actual excerpts in the book to show like, hey, there's not more source material here, right? We have the bare bones historical records that say that there was this harvest feast, but then we have the exact same thing is in Florida. I mean, it's not the exact same thing, but the exact same idea is that there's like two lines, right, that describe this. And Pedro Menendez de Avila, right, sets these multiple feast days. There's like several days where they celebrate these feats. The first being like just literally surviving the trip over is worth a feast day. But over the course of like these feast days, he basically says, or the priest that is with them basically says, the governor dined with the Indians, right? He hosted the Indians and dined with them. And, you know, that's it. It doesn't say anything more than that. But, you know, you can use the same arguments and the context might have been slightly different, but the feast was the same. The meaning was the same. You know, I would imagine that the Plymouth version had some religious overtones to it. The Spanish one would have as well. And then it's just objective historical fact that, you know, that happened in 1565. So that's 80 years earlier. So it's not exactly the same, but the form and function is the same.
The image of cowboys and cattle ranching culture is primarily associated with the Southwest region and American expansionism in later centuries. However, Dr. Cocomore argues that such traditions existed long before in the Southeast region and were rooted in Spanish customs.
For the first waves of Spanish settlers always brought pigs and horses and cattle with them. In fact, this conquistador tradition, this Hidalgo tradition, one of the most iconic aspects of a Hidalgo tradition is the horse and the right to a horse and the right to armor and the right to never have that taken away from you. And the cattle ranching tradition is this Southern Hispanic tradition. It's this Iberian tradition. Even the free range and the seasonal usage of the free range, right, is a Hispanic tradition. So everywhere they go, they bring cattle. And that North Florida area, which is so beautiful, right? The savannas in North Florida are just, they're just so naturally suited to ranching. The first Spanish settlements bring the first cattle. And not only the cattle, but the Hispanic Iberian tradition of seasonally using drives and culls and bringing to market. And we have evidence that St. Augustine had cattle. We have evidence that there's, you know, illegal cattle operations running out of San Marcos to Apalachee when it exists. Once Florida basically shrinks down just to St. Augustine, the cattle don't disappear. They basically go wild. And this area is so, the Alachua Savannah area, which is where the Seminoles settle, you know, that really is key to the identity of the Seminoles. And I latch on to Cowkeeper, like Ohio, like his identity is tied to cattle, right? When exactly does that start? Does that like literally start with Juan Ponce de Leon? Probably not, but it does start in the 16th century with the establishment of La Florida.
For many, Virginia 1619 marks the beginning of the institution of slavery in what would become the United States. However, when assessing America's early years through the lens of Spanish Florida, Dr. Cocomore asserts that such an unforgivable practice developed generations earlier in La Florida.
All of the traditions of chattel slavery existed in the Spanish world. And so the roads and the Castillo de San Marcos, I mean, that was built using slave labor. And it wasn't slave labor in any way different than any slave labor that existed in Virginia 100 years later. And like the first Thanksgiving is the intro, you know, I use 1619 basically as the conclusion to say that when 1619 happens because Dutch pirates raid a Spanish slavery system that already existed. And, you know, using the currents, the Dutch, basically pirates that are now slave raiders would have sailed right past St. Augustine, where slavery had already existed physically in Florida for generations already. Now, what's complicated about Florida's story is that Spain does have this very complicated relationship with slavery, and it means several different things. It's paradoxical. You know, there are free African-American communities in the same place that there's chattel slavery. There are the whole idea of protecting a frontier using armed freed slaves is actually quite Spanish. And so you have this situation where you have slavery in Spanish Florida, but you also have the Spanish using freedom as a weapon against the South Carolinians. And so in Florida, in St. Augustine, it is a crazy, complicated story where you could have the first traditions of chattel slavery in North America, and also the first traditions of basically resistance to slavery in North America at the same time, in the same place.
For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sebastian Garcia, a graduate history student, FHS media production assistant, and history podcaster at the University of Central Florida Department of History.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week. You can visit us anytime at myfloridahistory.org and listen as a podcast. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Sebastian Garcia. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.